Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. I'm your host, Darrell McClain, and let's get into our episode.
Simply search for the T-Bone and Chick Brew podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are sold.
The Darrell McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. You can get a membership for as little as $3 a month at www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcClain Show.
We talk about a lot of serious topics on this show. One very serious topic is women's health. One company that stood out to me was VSlay.com because the owner is very transparent about her own struggles in the women's health department and has great customer service, great deals, and frequent sales. You can check her out, her great customer service, products about women's health, and frequent sales at www.VSlay.com. That is www.VSlay.com. If patriotism was defined not as blind obedience to our government, nor as a submissive worship to flags and anthems, but rather as love of one's country, one's fellow citizens all over the world, as loyalty to principles of justice and democracy, then patriotism would require us to disobey our government when it violates those principles. Historically, the most terrible things, war, genocide, and slavery, have resulted not from disobedience, but from obedience. Our quote today comes from the late professor and author and World War II veteran, Howard Zinn. Welcome to the show. Let's get into this episode. So let me just start off by, I got to admit when I'm wrong about something, so here's a correction. This is the right wing Joe Rogan Exposed. So I'm going to go ahead and play this clip.
I really believe if Michelle Obama runs, she wins. She's good. She's great. She's right. The wife of the best president that we have had in our lifetime.
I've never voted right wing in my life.
I consider universal basic income a really good idea. I want free college education.
Take it easy.
Hello, Bernie.
How are you, Joe?
Wonderful. Pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I like Tulsi and I like Bernie. That's it.
Oh, yeah?
Everybody else can eat shit.
Look at you, fucking progressive.
Yeah. I think I'll probably vote for Bernie. I think he's looking out for the interests of the working people. And I think he wants people to have a better life and do better. And I'm all for that. And if that means I have to pay more in tax, like people think, oh, you're a socialist. I've heard people say that. Oh, you're a fucking socialist, bro. Like, first of all, he's not even a socialist. He's a democratic socialist. It's a different thing.
I would like to spend more in taxes if they could fix inner city communities and take these poor neighborhoods and spend more, you fucking Republican piece of shit.
87% of scientists said that human activity is driving global warming. I'm very pro-choice. I'm very women's rights, civil rights, gay rights, trans rights.
I'm even universal health care.
Obviously, this protected status is driving me crazy. This thing that Trump's doing with children that were born in other countries and then brought over here as children, and then they're talking about deporting them. That drives me fucking crazy.
Yeah, that's
crazy. And the hard right version of that is despicable. These people that I see online, why didn't they apply for citizenship? Oh, who knows? Maybe because they're fucking 13. I don't give a fuck if they broke the law. You don't take parents and kids and separate them. You just fucking don't. You know Alonzo?
He's a funny comedian.
Yeah. He said, he goes, not all Donald Trump supporters are racist, but all racists are Donald Trump supporters.
that
he definitely awakened that side.
But the January 6th thing is important.
See, it is important, it but is important. Isn't the 6 months later, is it should be the ruling number one conversation of the journalists?
I think it's really important. And one of the reasons why I think it's important, because it highlights the reasons why a guy like Donald Trump is so fucking dangerous. Mm-hmm. It's because a guy can incite a bunch of morons to do something really fucking stupid. As far as trans people, some trans people listening to this, I got nothing but love for you, for everybody. And in fact, Eddie Izzard is one of my all-time favorite guests.
Oh, I love Izzard.
The right-wing thing is just an easy way to dismiss me, because I'm not right-wing. I can't recommend your book, Race Matters, enough.
So, you know, I got to admit, you know, when I'm wrong. So anyway, there is a guy more famous than me, and that does a very, very good morning show. He has a lot of guests that I agree with and some that I disagree with. And I am talking about Charlemagne the God over at The Breakfast Club. So he weighed in on the Joe Rogan subject as well, and let's hear what Charlemagne the God had to say.
I mean, listen, if you've been in this business long enough as a broadcaster, you said something stupid. You said something that would be deemed problematic at some point. But when those things come back up, what can you do?
You got to apologize and take accountability.
Like I always say, you can't tell folks what to be mad at. Like, just because your intent wasn't malicious or your intent wasn't to offend, we can't tell folks how to react to the words that come out of your mouth. So you just got to deal with whatever comes your way when you say what you want. But I do want to know, what do folks want to happen? Like, when these old sound bites come out, right? You know, he apologized for them. What do you want to happen? Because this isn't the first time and won't be the last time, you know, we hear a white person using the N-word in context, out of context, quoting rappers, quoting comedians, whatever it is. So what do you want to happen next?
Wait, just Joe Rogan or in general?
Joe Rogan or just in general? Because this can happen to anybody at any given time if you've been in this business long enough. Broadcaster, I mean, rapper, comedian.
Like you said, you can't control how people react. So you work for a private company, they're going to make the decision ultimately on what they decide to do. So they pulled some of the episodes, but they're still standing by him. And I
think they should, because they knew all of this was before he even did the deal. So they knew that.
And then people have a right to be offended. I'm going to be honest, I've never listened to an episode of Joe Rogan ever.
I know you have, but I haven't.
So it's hard for me to say an opinion on somebody who I've never...
Yeah,
and that's the other thing.
I don't listen to too many. I've listened a couple of times, but also I don't know him, you know what I mean? And the people that seem like they know him say he's not a racist, say he's a good dude. So, I mean, what do you stand by?
I don't know him personally.
And look, I think that what Angela Yee just said was very, very important. It was honest where she said, I do not listen. I can't give an opinion about somebody that I don't listen to. And a lot of the criticisms that I've had, I've said the same thing. I said I have charged and asserted that most people who are making these complaints are literally looking at that out of context video that was leaked, or, you know, that was spliced by these party operatives, and they are going off of that, but they had themselves not listened to those episodes. And then there was also this narrative that, oh my goodness, these episodes were taken down because there were some racial stuff in it. And in fact, a lot of those episodes were taken down because of other reasons, like that Spotify has expanded in other markets, including Saudi Arabia, and some of the guests, including Cal Kalinske, was critical of Saudi Arabia, so those episodes got snatched. Had nothing to do with any type of racial slurs. Okay, so let me go back to this clip.
Yeah, I met him twice, you know what I mean? But I don't think he's racist. I've done his show. I met him at my man Andrew Schultz's wedding. I don't think he's a racist.
You say racist things and not be racist?
But I do think it's wild that if you look at, like, Joe Rogan, and you say, okay, well, they just scrubbed his whole episodes.
Some of them. Not a lot. There's a lot of episodes.
Then you look at somebody like Whoopi Goldberg, who gets suspended for 2 weeks.
Hold on. You said something that's very important. Just now. Can you say racist things and not be racist? Depending, right? Because you can say a slur, right? You can say a gay slur and not be homophobic, be homo-ignorant.
Correct.
Because a lot of times when we used to use that gay slur back in the day, it wasn't in reference to somebody's sexuality. right?
That's true. That's facts. You know?
So, yeah.
And look, that is a 100% true point. I know people that have said things that may come off as homophobic or racist, and they are not neither homophobic nor racist. I always think about this amazing thing, this quote, and he's gone now, but it's from the late great comedian Patrice O'Neill, where he talks about practically every person that makes a joke or says something, at the root, it comes from a place where they're really just trying to get you to laugh. And a lot of that stuff I put in that vein when I saw those, you know, little videos. And so I just wanted to at least get some nuance. You have a compilation of this one person saying these things over this 15-year period, taken out of context when, you know, and I don't think that's right. So I think Charlamagne hit the point so correctly when he said, if you are in this broadcasting business for any significant period of time, you're going to run into that thing where eventually you're going to say something that is silly. You're going to say something that people disagree with. And that's literally just the price of the ticket. That you are out here speaking your mind, and eventually you're going to say something that is stupid. And so I think that we all have to, as much as we try to have ironclad pros and everything like that, we still need to recognize that at the end of the day, we're all humans, and we operate from that vantage point. So on to a more serious topic. We keep seeing what's happening in the ramping up of rhetoric for Ukraine and the United States. And I want to get onto this topic by reading something that was really good from a sitting U.S. senator, who you may know by the name of Bernie Sanders. So before I play that video, I want to play something from someone who is a bit of a dissident. She does have very different opinions about certain things, and I really did like the presence that she held on the stage when she was running. So this is going to be from the former congresswoman who ran for president, who is a veteran, a sofer, a soldier, a yoga practitioner. She's got a lot of different views, but this is from former congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard.
Here's something you are not going to hear on the mainstream media. What you do hear is warmongers arguing that we must protect Ukraine because it is a quote-unquote democracy. But they're lying. Ukraine isn't actually a democracy. For example, to hold on to power, Ukraine's president shut down the three TV stations that were openly criticizing him and his policies, imprisoned the head of the opposition political party that had come in second place in their elections, and went and arrested and jailed that party's leaders. This is exactly what Putin has been accused of doing. But Ukraine did this all with the support of the United States.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It goes without saying that this show does not happen without listener support. Support the Darrell McClain Show by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for $3. Or you can go to buzzsprouts.com/the Darrell McClain Show. And hit the subscribe button and join there. Many ways to donate to the show. Independent media that won't reinforce tribalism. We have one planet. Nobody is leaving. So let us reason together. patreon.com/TheDarrellMcLean Show, or go to Buzzsprouts and to The Darrell McLean Show and subscribe. So I think that's always a point to be made, is that a lot of times when you hear about these authoritarian leaders around the world, especially when it comes to places like Latin America, there's a lot of caveats that are left out. And that big caveat that always points out to me is with the U.S. being its ally, at the U.S.'s behest, with the U.S. knowing this is happening. And a lot of times it always comes with foreign aid attached to that as well. One of the most famous examples I can always think of is when Saddam Hussein committed his most vigorous atrocities against the Kurdish people. That happened when he was a U.S. ally. That happened when you could go back and look at those pictures of Saddam Hussein and Donald Rumsfeld hand in hand. So, at any rate, the opinion piece that I'm going to link to in the show notes is from Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, and it says, "We must do everything possible to avoid an enormously destructive war in Ukraine. I am concerned when I hear a familiar drumbeat in Washington demanding we show strength when we're faced with what could be the worst European war in 75 years. Wars have unintended consequences. They rarely turn out the way the experts tell us they will. Just ask the official who provided rosy scenarios from wars in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq, only to be proven horribly wrong. Just ask the mothers of the soldiers who were killed or wounded in action during those wars. Just ask the millions of civilians who became collateral damage. This is why we must do everything possible to try to find a diplomatic solution to what could be an enormously destructive war in Ukraine. No one knows exactly what the human cost of such a war would be, but there are estimates that there could be over 50,000 civilian casualties in Ukraine and millions of refugees flooding neighboring countries as they flee what would be the worst European conflict since the Second World War. In addition, of course, there would be many thousands of deaths within the Ukrainian and Russian militaries. There is also the possibility that this regional war could escalate to other parts of Europe. What might happen then is even more horrifying. But that's not all. The sanctions against Russia and Russia-threatened responses to those sanctions could result in massive economic upheaval with impacts on energy, banking, food, and the day-to-day needs of the ordinary people throughout the entire world. It is likely that Russia will not be only suffering from the sanctions. And by the way, any hope of international cooperation to address the existential threat of global climate crisis and the future pandemics will suffer a major setback. We should be clear about what is most responsible for the looming crisis. Vladimir Putin. Having already seized parts of Ukraine in 2014, the Russian president now threatens to take over the entire country and destroy the Ukrainian democracy. In my view, we must unequivocally support the sovereignty of Ukraine and make it clear that the international community would impose severe consequences on Putin and his associates if he does not change course. With that said, I am extremely concerned when I hear the familiar drumbeats in Washington. The bellicose rhetoric that gets amplified before every war, demanding that we must show strength, get tough, and not engage in appeasement. A simplistic refusal to recognize the complex roots of the tension in the region undermines the ability to negotiate to reach a peaceful resolution. One of the participating factors of the crisis, at least from Russia's perspective, is the prospect of an enhanced security relationship between Ukraine and the United States and Western Europe, including what Russia sees as a threat of Ukraine joining the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, NATO, a military alliance created in 1949 to confront the Soviet Union.
It is good to know some history. When Ukraine became independent after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, Russian leaders made clear that their concerns about the prospect of the former Soviet Union states became a part of NATO, posting a hostile military force along the Russian borders. U.S. leaders recognized these concerns as legitimate at the time. They are still legitimate concerns. Invasion by Russia is not an answer. Neither is it intransigent by NATO. It is also important to recognize that Finland, one of the most developed and democratic countries in the world, borders Russia and has chosen not to be a member of NATO. Putin may be a liar and a demagogue, but it is hypocritical for the United States to insist that we do not accept the principles of spheres of influence. For the last 200 years, our country has operated under the Monroe Doctrine, embracing the preeminence that as the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere. The United States has the right to intervene against any country that might threaten our allied interests. Under this doctrine, we have undermined and overthrown at least a dozen governments. In 1962, we came to the brink of nuclear war with the Soviet Union in response to a placement of Soviet missiles in Cuba, 90 miles from our shore, which the Kennedy administration saw as an unacceptable threat to our national security. And the Monroe Doctrine is not ancient history. As recently as 2018, Donald Trump's Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, called the Monroe Doctrine as relevant today as it was the day it was written. In 2019, Trump's former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, declared the Monroe Doctrine is alive and well. To put it simply, even if Russia was not ruled by a corrupt authoritarian leader like Vladimir Putin, Russia, like the United States, would still have an interest in the security policies of its neighbors. Does anyone really believe that the United States would not have something to say if, for example, Mexico was to form a military alliance with a U.S. Adversary? Countries should be free to make their own foreign policy choices, but making those choices wisely requires a serious consideration of the costs and the benefits. The fact is that the U.S. and Ukraine entering into a deeper security relationship is likely to have some very serious costs for both countries. We must vigorously support diplomatic efforts to de-escalate this crisis and reaffirm Ukraine's independence and sovereignty. And we must make clear that Putin and his gang of oligarchs will face major consequences should he continue down the current path. At the same time, we must never forget the horrors that a war in the region would cause and must work hard to achieve a realistic and mutually agreeable resolution, one that is acceptable to Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and our European allies, that prevents what would be the worst European war in over 75 years. You know, I think that particular article struck the right tone, because this, if treated wrong, and I don't want to be flippant about this, but this particular conflict, if it does not go correctly, could lead us to World War III. I watched where the Russian president was embraced by the Chinese leader, Xi Jinping. And this was done because they wanted to show that there was an alliance between China and Russia. I've been watching very carefully as the French president, Macron, who is has more stake in this conflict then the United States, has been working very diligently to broker a peaceful resolution to this conflict. And his rhetoric is not as fired up and as charged as is coming out of Washington, who has the least to lose in this conflict. Putin's behaviors have been well documented. The invasion of Crimea documented, the invasion of Georgia documented, and the annexing and attempting to annex parts of Ukraine documented. So this is
something that is undebatable. But I also think a part of that record, it always has to be that when George Herbert Walker Bush said that the United States would not expand, our NATO would not expand eastward, that ever since we said it, there has been an expansion eastward, and it has been done with the pretext that there's actually not an official treaty. NATO never signed any document they wouldn't expand eastward, so we have been creeping eastward since we have said that. So, Russia as a superpower is going to respond appropriately to any other superpower that it seems getting closer and closer to its shores. I think the right comparison that was made is how the United States reacted in the Cuban Missile Crisis when Russia was seen as trying to put missiles into Cuba, which was 90 miles away from the United States. So in that same way, Russia does not want NATO forces right on their border, because if the analysis is correct that the U.S. pays the majority of NATO's budget, some estimates say 85%, then it is, you can reason that when NATO does something, it is as if the United States is doing it. So I'm going to pay very close attention to this, because the drumbeats of war are always loud, they're always persistent, because there's money to be made. There's an old saying, and it's kind of colloquial now, and it's war is old men debating and young men dying. And I have seen too many of my friends go off to these wars of regime change, of wars of nation building, of, even though people don't like the term, of forever wars, and they have either not come back, or they have come back and everything, there is large parts of them that have been left on that battlefield. And although I do believe that there is a time for war and a time for peace, I will always try to point at both sides of these arguments and not just go with the talking points that are coming out of the Pentagon press corps. And unfortunately, there's a lot of times where the people who should know better, who should be holding these people accountable, they act as nothing but stenographers for the official analysis that is coming out of the intel communities. They repeat verbatim what's coming out of the Pentagon. They repeat verbatim was coming from the intel community, and they repeat verbatim was coming from the press corps lectern. And it's very easy for them to do so because their kids are not going to be the ones fighting in these battles. So thank you to the independent senator from Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders, for this op-ed. I will link to the op-ed in the show notes. So a big story that is all over the TV and a lot of reporting came out from the New York Times as well, was that the accounting firm that prepared the Trump's financial statements. So the accounting firm has now cut ties with President Trump, and it actually retracted its financial statements. The firm, Mazars USA, said in a letter that it could no longer stand behind the able statements, which are central to an investigation by the New York Attorney General. Now, Donald Trump's longtime accounting firm cut ties with him and his family business last week, saying it could no longer stand behind a decade of able financial statements it prepared for the Trump Organization, court documents show. The decision, which is disclosed to the company in February 9th letter from the accounting firm, comes amid the criminal and civil investigations of whether Trump illegally inflated the value of his assets. The firm, Mazars USA, compiled the financial statements based on information the former president and his company provided.
The letter instructed the Trump Organization to essentially retract the documents known as Statements of Financial Condition from 2011 to 2020. In the letter, it noted that the firm had not, as a whole, found material discrepancies between the information of the Trump Organization provided and the actual value of Trump's asset, but given what is called the totality of circumstances, including Mazars' own investigation, the letter directed the Trump Organization to notify anyone who receives those statements that they can no longer rely on them. The statements, which Trump used to secure loans, are at the center of two law enforcement investigations into whether the Trump exaggerated the value of his properties to defraud his lenders into providing him the best possible loan terms. Now, the firm's acknowledgement that the statements were fundamentally flawed was a potential blow to the Trump Organization as it attempts to fend off long-running scrutiny of his finances, and for President Trump, whose personal finances are intertwined with those of his family businesses, who have long faced questions about his taxes. The firm is the latest in a long line of companies to break with him over the last year, following in the path of several banks, insurers, and lawyers. Now, the disclosure about Mazars' work for President Trump appeared in the new court documents filed by the New York Attorney General Letita James, who is seeking to question the former president and two of his adult children under oath as part of a civil investigation. President Trump's lawyers had asked the judge to prohibit questioning, and in response, Ms. James' office argued in court papers last month that the company has engaged in fraudulent, misleading practices. Her filing on Monday, which marked her latest attempt to press ahead with questioning Trump, as well as Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka Trump, included a copy of the Mazars' letter signed by the accounting firm's general counsel. Now, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office has been conducting a separate criminal investigation with the assistance of the lawyers from Ms. James' office. In a statement, The Trump Organization said that while it was disappointed with the decision, it viewed the letter as a confirmation that the firm's work was performed in accordance with all applicable accounting standards and principles, as such statements of financial condition do not contain any material discrepancies. The company argued that the characterization of the work effectively renders the investigation by the DA, Attorney General, moot. Mazars first moved to split with the Trump Organization last spring and went down its work during a transition to a new accounting firm, according to people with knowledge of the relationship. But the letter withdrawing the statements represents a sharper break, and its disclosure in the court filing was the first time the end of business relationship had been made public. In a statement, the accounting firm said that under our standards of professional ethics, we cannot comment on any client services or relationships. Now, the firm's brief letter, though, could bolster Mrs. James' investigation, which is focused partly on statements and whether they overvalued Trump's various hotels, golf clubs, and other properties. Mazars said it concluded that the statements were no longer reliable based on part of the Attorney General's earlier filings in its own investigation and information the accountants received from internal and external sources. The letter added that Mazars performed its work in accordance with professional standards. Because Ms. James' investigation is civil, she cannot file criminal charges, but she could sue Mr. Trump and his company to seek financial penalties, and she could try to shut down certain aspects of Trump's businesses in New York. As the most recent filings demonstrate, the evidence continues to mount, showing that Donald J. Trump and the Trump Organization used fraudulent and misleading financial statements to obtain economic benefits, end quote. Ms. James said that in a statement, and she also included, there should be no doubt that this is a lawful investigation, that we have legitimate reasons to seek testimony from Donald J. Trump, Donald J. Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump. Now, it is unclear whether Mazars' break with Trump will have any bearing on the district attorney's criminal investigation into Mr. Trump. The firm has been cooperating with that investigation, and Trump's main accountant at Mazars has already testified before the grand jury hearing evidence about former President Trump. Now, sticking with the president for this next story, there is no mass exodus, but the GOP sees Trump grips on the party actually loosening. Now, Donald Trump's vice-like grip on the GOP and showing signs of easing, even as the former president looks to maintain his party boss status ahead of the 2022 midterm elections and a potential 2024 White House bid. Now, while the former president's influence over the Republican Party and its voters remains unmatched, party strategists and operatives have begun to wonder if that will last, and if so, for how long, pointing to growing differences between Trump and other Republicans over the direction of the Grand Old Party. Quote, there's been a few people out there predicting that the mass exodus from Trump. This isn't that, one veteran Republican consultant said, but the truth is he's just less of a factor than he was 2 years ago or 4 years ago. There's more leeway to go in your own direction. Now, that reality, the consultant said, is playing out in Republican primaries across the country. In the race for Georgia Governor incumbent Brian Kemp is out raising his Trump endorsement primary opponent, former Senator David Perdue, despite former President Trump's vow to oust him last year. Now, meanwhile, in the Senate races in Alabama, North Carolina, and Alaska, Trump's preferred candidates haven't yet managed to run away with the GOP nomination and are locked in tough primary battles that will ultimately be seen as a test of the former president's sway. Quote, I think even a couple of years ago, it would have been a lot riskier to stay in a primary against one of his candidates, the consultant said. I'm not saying his endorsement doesn't matter. There's just a path forward without it now. Now, Trump has sought to assert his dominance within the GOP, releasing a statement on Sunday pushing back against the notion that his power is waning. He insisted that his endorsement remains more powerful now than it was in 2020, the last time he was on the ballot, and blamed the media for downplaying his political strength. Quote, there are plenty of existing politicians who wouldn't be in power now. We're not for my endorsement, like the old crow, he added, using his nickname for Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. The fake news does everything within their power to diminish and belittle, but people know, and the politicians seeking the endorsement really know. Now, that's end quote from President Trump. Now, while Trump remains deeply popular among Republican voters, there are still some signs that his base of hardcore supporters may be shrinking. A NBC News poll released last month found that the majority of Republicans, 56%, see themselves as more supportive of the GOP than of Donald Trump. Meanwhile, 36% said that they see themselves as more supportive of Trump himself than the Grand Old Party. By comparison, a similar poll from 2020 found that 54% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents saw themselves as being more supportive of Trump than the party as a whole, while 38% say they were more supportive of the GOP than the former president. And while early polling shows Trump as a favorite to clinch the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, there are signs that the other would-be candidates still have a fighting chance. Harvard's Caps Harris poll survey filed last month found Trump as the clear favorite for the GOP nod, garnering 57% support. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former Vice President Mike Pence were deadlocked in second place at 12% and 11%, respectively. But without Trump on the ticket, DeSantis scored 30%, supporting that he still may have a lane in the 2024 race, especially if Trump foregoes another campaign. So, indeed, Trump does face some clear challenges in his quest to maintain his grip on the GOP. Once an avid Twitter user, he has been banned from some of the world's most widely used social media sites, depriving him of a platform that helped fuel his political rise. At the same time, Trump's intense focus on his baseless claims that the 2020 presidential election was stolen has driven a wedge between him and some Republican leaders who are eager to move ahead to the 2020 midterms. The rift with the GOP was on full display earlier this month when the Republican National Committee voted to ensure Rep. Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger for their roles in the House Committee investigation of January 6th, riots on Capitol. So that's that censor that I was talking about, that they officially censored those two. And then, of course, Mitch McConnell came out and said he thought it was a bad move, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, the censor vote was seen as a show of loyalty to Trump, which signaled out both Cheney and Kissinger for criticism, but it also drew widespread condemnation from many in the party, particularly Senate Republicans, who saw those moves as divisive and unnecessary distraction from their efforts to flip the control of Congress. Don Hay, a GOP strategist and former communications director for the RNC, said the vote underscores the conflicting priorities of Trump and other Republican leaders who want to keep focus on midterm elections, on the issues like the economy and the coronavirus pandemic that flies in the face of someone who always tries to make himself the story. He said the part of the political yin and yang that the Republican Party finds itself in right now, certainly there's a strong difference in opinion. Trump's allies were quick to downplay the notion that his influence with the GOP is diminishing, with one former campaign aide pointing to the early polling showing that Trump has a clear favorite to win 2024 presidential nomination. The fact that he's been kicked off Twitter, he doesn't get the wall-to-wall coverage that he used to get, and he still has the level of support. There's no good faith argument that he's weaker now than he used to be, the aide said. He's exactly where he should be right now. Now, other Republicans are more circumspect in their assessment of Trump's standing with the party. Matt Terrell, the Republican strategist, noted that Trump has frequently found himself at odds with the GOP leaders. Quote, if you want to see where you're going in the future, go back and look at the history. Look at Donald Trump being on the political stage, Terrell said. You've always had prominent Republican leaders push back on him and publicly disagree with him or take that approach. But you often seen his, by large, they stood by him. It's about unity, he added. While Trump and the Republican Party right now is largely united around Donald Trump, the question is, will it stay that way?
On the very first day of Black History Month, at least a dozen bomb threats were made against historically Black colleges and universities. This sort of harassment is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to injustices facing HBCUs. Here are three major inequities HBCUs are dealing with. Funding inequality. These schools are receiving less government funding, even when it's legally required. In 2020, the Tennessee General Assembly granted nearly $70 million to the University of Tennessee, which has a 77% white student body. And the historically Black Tennessee State University only got $8.7 million. Both schools are considered land-grant universities, which qualifies them to receive federal funding. In Tennessee, the state legislature is supposed to match whatever federal funding the schools receive, but the state didn't provide any matched funding for TSU until 2017. And Tennessee Representative Harold Love found that the state underpaid the HBCU by up to $500 million. And it's not just Tennessee. Ivy League schools like Harvard and Yale sell tax-exempt bonds to raise cash. Studies have shown that HBCUs have a harder time securing bonds, and they pay more for them. On an average $30 million bond, HBCUs are paying $35,000 more in fees than mostly white universities. Coronavirus relief inequality. When it came to federal relief for higher education institutions disrupted by the pandemic, of the $14 million given out, only 10% of that money was divided among all 107 HBCUs. And since about three-quarters of HBCU students fall into the lower-income bracket, combine that with the fact that people in lower-income housing have a harder time accessing reliable internet access, remote classes can become a huge challenge. Unequal campus infrastructure. A 2018 report found that almost all HBCUs reported that about 50% of their facilities needed repair. Some of these campuses have buildings that date back to the 1800s. After years of deferred maintenance due to budget concerns, Grambling State University had to close a library because it became an environmental hazard. These historic institutions are not only providing a critical pipeline into the workforce, they are essential threads in the fabric of American society. Their neglect impacts the entire country, and there's a huge responsibility on elected leaders to ensure that they thrive.
So that data entry point that I just put in the show that you heard is courtesy of a reporting agency called The Recount.
Some topics go without comment because I don't expect much movement on a lot of issues that are as common sense. Like if you are supposed to be funding a program and you're not funding it, I know that that is a position that somebody has chosen to take. And it's up to those people in those communities to decide if it is going to be a priority to find out why the money that they are paying taxes for is not being used for what it is supposed to be used for.
I had the distinct pleasure of doing some security work for a historically black college in Virginia, Hampton University, and I can attest to the fact that although the students were well behaved and the teachers were polite and professional, the buildings were older, and I juxtaposed my time at Hampton University to my time when I was the head of security for Virginia Tech. And that university, everything was state of the art. The facilities were newer, well maintained. So I saw the difference just between those two universities. And it is not just a position or a matter of what I think the specific deans choose to do or with how the resources are used. I think a lot of it, if this reporting is correct, has to do with the getting the resources, period. I'm always happy when I see engagement on the Daryl McLean Show, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And I had a lot of engagement this week. I was actually asked about the NFL halftime show, which I did not watch, just to be honest. But because somebody asked me a question of what I thought about it, I try to give them some feedback. So, the Dr. Cornel West said the Super Bowl halftime performance displayed our great black musical tradition, but it was also a missed opportunity for truth-telling about Brian Flores and challenges to the NFL's plantation system. Aside from Brother Eminem's kneeling, the political silence of our artists was sad. So again, that is the analysis from Dr. Cornel West. I also heard Dr. Carl Mack have a bit to say about it as well as Brother Dave Zirin, who is a sports commentator.
That I have. Were I asked to participate at that halftime show, in light of what is happening with Brian Flores, trust and believe, I would have rejected it. I would have literally said I am not performing, and specifically why I'm not performing. I am not performing at this show. I get the opportunity that it could afford me, but I'm also looking at the sacrifice of what this brother is making. And if change is going to become a part of it, then don't think that you can use me to cloud the vision of what we as black folks should truly see. And that is an institution that is worth billions and billions of dollars under a nonprofit status. Lord, yes, I don't understand. That's right. Government. But for almost 100 plus years, you have treated black players, black coaches, as though it was a plantation system. And the only way that we've been able to get around it is to continuously fight it. Not only did you do it first, you wanted to exclude black players.
That's right.
Then when it came to quarterback, and that's why we celebrated Doug Williams the way we did, because I remember when so many of you believed that blacks didn't have the intellectual, the mental capability of being the general, to be the quarterback on the field, and you kept them out. I'm not going to forget about all the yards that Warren Moon had up in the Canadian Football League, because you wouldn't give him an opportunity to play quarterback here. I'm not going to remember how when blacks were drafted for quarterback, drafted after playing quarterback in college, you now wanted to convert them to a receiver, a running back, hell, maybe even a linebacker. I'm not going to forget those things. I'm not going to forget the fact that you got so many talented black players who are now sitting on the sidelines, being offensive coordinators, defensive coordinators, coming up through the ranks, more than qualified to be black coaches, and you won't do it. And you think that I'm going to forget about all that because I heard Snoop and Dr. Dre and Mary J. Blige and 50 Cent. I ain't forget. My memory is worth more than 50 Cent.
I mean, here's the National Football League, which has a reputation for bathing in black culture, but not necessarily supporting that with black employment in positions of power. This is the crux of what the NFL's PR problem is right now with America. You know, as the expression goes, they want all of the rhythm of black culture, but none of the blues. So they're in this position where they do this halftime show that is very much this expression of, hey, this is hip-hop. We're the National Football League. We're down with the youth, even though the youth is more people like my age, given some of the acts that were on display. But at the same time, they're in this position where they're facing this lawsuit by Brian Flores about hiring practices and about how things happen behind closed doors in the National Football League. So right now, they're in a position where they're both trying to be everything to everybody, while at the same time trying to not push away a young audience that is more demographically diverse and less tolerant of intolerance than any generation in the history of the United States, while at the same time trying not to lose their, for lack of a better term, red state appeal and continue to be, and it's very difficult to do in this incredibly polarized country, but they want to continue to be the closest thing we have to a monoculture in the United States. I mean, the top 100 television shows that were watched last year, 75 of them were NFL games.
Supreme Court for a moment. Can you rule out that the president would be meeting with any of his candidates this weekend at Camp David?
Here's what I can tell you. I there's not plans for that, but I can tell you that it could be as early as next week. I would not echo reporting that it is definitely next week.
Given the heightened state of concern about Russia and Ukraine, does that at all affect the timetable for the president on his Supreme Court pick, simply because of the time and attention he would need to devote to that, and because Senate Democrats were very upfront saying they're encouraging the president to move quickly? Do you sense that there is an increase in the tempo for the president to move on his selection process?
We remain on track for the president to make a decision and announcement on who he's going to nominate to the Supreme Court this month, in the next few weeks. That was his intention from the beginning, remains his intention now, and he will continue to read a range of cases, study the materials about a range of candidates. That has not been changed by whatever decision President Putin makes.
The White House is using Republicans' own rhetoric from past Supreme Court confirmation proceedings to rebut some of the criticisms conservatives have levied on President Biden as he prepares to nominate a successor to fill the vacancy created by Justice Breyer's retirement. Now, the White House has been proactive about reaching out to Republicans and courting the support of senators who might reach across the aisles to back Biden's eventual pick, but officials have been just as quick to cite the GOP's own comments praising the choice of a woman to fill the seat on the high court during the confirmation process, in which former President Trump chose Justice Amy Coney Barrett to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The White House is also dismantling suggestions that Biden should be deferring to the Senate more or expanding his search, pointing out the GOP senators in the past have said a Supreme Court pick is at the discretion of the president. The strategy marks a preview of some of the tactics Democrats may use to undercut arguments from the Republicans once Biden puts forward his actual nominee, which is expected to happen by the end of February. A handful of Republicans have already suggested that Biden has yet to be named nominee will be opposed just by the president's pledge to nominate a black woman to the court. The White House has been quick to point to Trump, who said he would nominate a woman to replace Ginsburg when she died in September of 2020. Senator Roger Wicker, a Republican from Mississippi, in a radio interview last month suggested whomever Biden chose to replace Breyer would be a beneficiary of affirmative action. Now, the irony is that the Supreme Court is the very same time having a case about this sort of affirmative action and racial discrimination while adding someone who is a beneficiary of that sort of quota, Wicker said in an interview on Super Talk Mississippi Radio. The White House, in turn, used Wicker's own comments upon the nomination of Barrett to the court in 2020. When the prominent president followed through on his own promise to place a woman on the Supreme Court, Senator Wicker said, "I have 5 granddaughters. The oldest one is 10. I think Justice Amy Coney Barrett will prove to be an inspiration to these 5 granddaughters. To my grown daughters," Deputy White House Press Secretary Andrew Bates said in response to Whitaker. Now, Barrett's confirmation proceeding also came up when the White House looked at looked to bat down criticism from Senator Ted Cruz, the Republican from Texas, who called it offensive that Biden was excluding other candidates from the offset by promising to nominate a black woman. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki responded by noting that Cruz appears to have no issue when Trump said he would choose a woman to replace Ginsburg. Psaki went on to criticize and cite Cruz's own comments during Barrett's confirmation hearing when he said, "I think you're an amazing role model for little girls. What advice would you give little girls?" End quote. And the White House has similarly used a Republican favorite former President Ronald Reagan to debunk arguments like the ones Cruz said and some of his colleagues as well. Psaki and others have highlighted Reagan's promise to nominate a woman to the Supreme Court, which he did when he appointed former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. When Biden's official note to the lack of Republican resistance to promises from the likes of Trump and Reagan to nominate certain type of judges to the Supreme Court, they may similarly look to highlight the comments from senators who in the past suggested a president deserves broad deference when picking a Supreme Court justice. Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, in a floor speech at the time of Barrett's nomination, lamented that the Supremes, that the Senate no longer judged a candidate solely on their credentials. Quote, "We looked at the qualifications and said, okay, you're good to go. You're a person of integrity. You're smart. You're well-rounded. You're knowledgeable of the law," Graham said in October 2020 speech. "You may have a different philosophy than I have, but we understand elections matter, and everybody accepted the election outcome," end quote. Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, delivered remarks in 2017 during Justice Neil Gorsuch's confirmation proceeding in which she said the president has wide discretion when it comes to the nominations to the Supreme Court. "The Senate's role is not to ask. It is this person whom I would have chosen to sit on the bench, whether the Senate is charged with evaluating each nominee's qualifications for serving on the court." Just after Breyer's announcement of his retirement, however, Collins said she believed Biden had politicized the process by promising to choose a black woman to serve on the high court during his campaign, and as opposed to where Trump and Reagan indicated they would do so. "It adds to further perception that the court is a political institution like Congress when it's not supposed to be. So I certainly am open to whoever he decides to nominate. My job as a senator is to evaluate qualifications of the person under the advice and consent role," Collins said. White House officials have been in touch with Collins as Biden vets potential choices, and Grams has strongly advocated for Judge J. Michelle Childs, who sits on the federal bench in his home state of South Carolina. Graham has also been among the Republicans who have said they would have no issue with Biden's pledge to nominate a black woman. "Put me in the camp of making sure the court and other institutions look like America," Graham said recently. "You know, we make real efforts as Republicans to recruit women on people of color to make the party look more like America," end quote. Now, while officials acknowledge that they won't win over hardliners like Cruz in the nomination fight, the White House has still been aggressive in engaging with Republicans to solicitate input and keep them informed on the process. Biden met with Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, the top Republican on the Judiciary Committee, and he spoke on the phone with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Republican from Kentucky. "He's going to choose a nominee whose qualifications record character and devotion to the Constitution and a rule of law, make them deserving and support for both sides of the aisle," Psaki said Wednesday. "And there are many candidates at the top of their fields who fit that profile. And we have received bipartisan support in the past," end quote. Now, the president is certainly seeking input, seeking feedback, she added, but he is treating the process that he believes it should be treated, which is with seriousness, which is approaching it from a bipartisan manner and seeking engagement and advice from a range of officials, and that is both elected and non-elected. So let me go ahead and end the show by being a broken record. The Supreme Court is a political institution. It has always been such. The presidents appoint people that have their political ideology, not the other way around. You're not going to see
conservative president appointing liberal justices, and you will not see a liberal president appointing conservative justices because it is a political institution, is another arm of politics. We just all pretend like it's not, but that is just another myth-making thing that we like to do. Anyway, thank you for tuning in today. Of course, if you want to support the show, do so by going to www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcLean Show, and I will see you on the next episode. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for as little as $3 a month. Again, that's www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcLean Show. The Darrell McLean Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. Get a membership and support independent media at www.patreon.com/TheDarrell McLean Show.